Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Well, we're doing a little bit of a mashup today on Theology Thursday, which Dr. Grant Wacker is here with me, who's served for years at Duke Divinity School there at Duke, of course, in Durham, North Carolina, PhD from Harvard, BA from Stanford, and taught for years at Duke Divinity, and has been on the show before when we talked about Billy Graham with his first book about Billy Graham, and then he's got another book out about Billy Graham that just came out called One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham, which is more about Billy as an individual as opposed to Billy's ministry. And so all of my Southeastern friends, because Grant, we do every Thursday, we do Theology Thursday. We have all for about 4.5 years. Uh-huh. So Danny Aiken, the president of the seminary, is on once a month. Okay. And then I have other professors from the seminary on. And then this week, all their schedules collapsed. And so I had a hole. So that's why I called our good friend Todd Von Helms, who's one of the grads of Duke Divinity School. And all of a sudden, he has said many times, just full disclosure here, Grant. He's like, you got to get Grant Wacker back on. You got to get, and I'm like, you're right, I do. And so it's been years, though. Welcome back. It's been years we did radio together.
Thank you. Yeah, good 5 years. Yeah,
good 5 years. Is it good because it's been 5 years? That sounds like it's good. It's good that it's been so long.
Well, you haven't changed a bit. I mean, yeah.
But you've retired. How long did you teach at Duke Divinity?
25 years.
That's a long time.
And before then, I taught 15 years at that school across the highway that we don't always need to name, but I was looking for a better basketball team. So,
okay, you just want my inbox to be filled with all kinds of emails.
Well, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yes, exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So how did you end up at Duke? Because obviously highly educated and years of 25 years at Duke, but how'd you end up there? Kind of what's your life story? And then we'll talk about Billy Graham after that.
Okay. After graduate school, my first job was at University of North Carolina.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Southwest Missouri in what was then a little town called Springfield. It's now a big town.
Yes, it is.
Springfield has become a medical center of some repute, and the real attraction there is Branson, which is only 40 miles away. But anyway, grew up there and then migrated out to college and graduate school, and my first job was at UNC. And stayed there for 15 years in the Department of Religious Studies. Why did I go to Duke? Well, partly just a change. I didn't want to spend my entire life in one place, but also because of the Divinity School. I wanted to teach Divinity students. And when I got to Duke, I had the great fortune of also teaching doctoral students in Religious Studies and sometimes in the college, too. But the heart of it was the Divinity School. And I was talking a little earlier with Steve about it, what I find really appealing about the Divinity students is their earnestness. They care about not only life, but the life of the church. And students of all theological stripes, and yet what they are committed to uniformly is the life of the church.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because we talked about that earlier, because you say Duke Divinity, and in certain evangelical circles, they're going, oh, and all the bells go off, and all the alarms go off, and the red flashing lights and everything. And I asked you, and you said probably about 25% of the students at Duke Divinity we would call theologically conservative, and then 75% kind of mainstream, mainline denominations. It must be a fascinating environment to be in, because like here, when I've done all my master's work here at Southeastern, there's no blend. Everybody's pretty much really hardcore conservative evangelical. But in that environment, which our mutual friend Todd Von Helms, one of the reasons he went there is to be involved in an environment that had wasn't homogeneous, but was varied, because it really, I think it probably helped his heart and it helped his communication skills. Mm-hmm. How do you invest in people that you disagree with on some very serious issues? But what's that experience been like for you all those years at Duke Divinity?
I've loved it. You know, like any job, here and there, there's some little tiny quirks, but on the whole, I've loved it, and I've just counted myself extraordinarily fortunate to be there. And the mix of students and the mix of faculty has been exhilarating for me. You know, like the conversations, and people disagree with me, and I disagree with them, and it puts you back on the drawing board very often. You know, why do I think that?
Yeah, why do I actually believe these things that I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's healthy.
Yeah, but what I also find, have found in the Divinity School, is not only the commonality of the concern and love for the church, the institutional denominational church, and we're not talking about, you know, broad movements, we're talking about churches, denominations, but also the centrality of worship. Hmm. There are two worship services a day, in the morning at 8 a.m., Anglican prayers, and then 11 o'clock, 4 days a week, standard worship service, and then a revival service on Friday afternoons. So the range of styles has been valuable, but also the commitment, students' commitment to those services.
Yeah. A lot of people go to Duke because it's one of the finest institutions of higher learning in the country.
Yeah.
It costs a boatload
yeah.
of money, 60 grand plus to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are going to be money-making machines when they
right,
get out.
Right, yeah.
But not at Duke Divinity.
No.
You're not there because you're going to go set the world on fire in terms of financial success.
Not financially, no.
Something deeper drives you. Yeah, what were some of the classes that you taught? And then we're talking to Dr. Grant Wacker, who's retired now from Duke Divinity, a PhD from Harvard and a BA from Stanford. But what were the main kind of concentrations of what you taught over the years?
Well, I taught American Christian history. And I wish I could say I had taught a whole bunch more than that, but I mean that was the focus, and a range of things within that framework: the missionary impulse in America, evangelicalism, biography, and biography and culture. Right now, I've gone back for a semester, and I'm teaching a seminar. On Christianity and politics
oh,
and
piece
American
of cake.
History.
Nothing yeah. could go wrong in that class.
No, not at all. But we have an agreement.
Do you have any Steve Noble type people in that class?
I just really couldn't say.
You would
yet.
Know if you
yet,
did.
Yeah. I'm just waiting for the lid to blow off, and I'll find out right now.
On that, and we're coming up on a break, but on that, looking at the history of Christianity and the church in America. Of course, has Billy Graham been on your radar screen pretty much the whole of your Christian life?
No. Interestingly, no. I saw Billy Graham when I was 12 years old, and that was in 1957. You can do the arithmetic on that. That was at his crusade in New York City.
Yeah.
And what I remember of that 12-year-old experience is how funny he was.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about the substance of the sermon, but I do remember laughing.
Something that a lot of people don't know about them. We're talking to Dr. Grant Wacker. We're going to talk about his, not one, but two books about Billy Graham when we come back right after this. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble Theology Thursday today with Dr. Grant Wacker, who served for 25 years at Duke Divinity and taught at various levels and is retired now. We did a show several years ago, about 5 years ago. We were introduced through a mutual friend, Todd Von Helms, who's been on this show many times, and Todd will be back on soon in the near future because he's got a fabulous book coming out. But we had the opportunity, the schedule kind of fell through with our friends here at Southeastern, and Dr. Wacker was available in 25 years, but retired, has written now two books about Dr. Billy Graham. The first one is really more about the ministry, and this one called One Soul at a Time, the story of Billy Graham. It's much more focused on Billy as an individual. But you were mentioning you were at the Madison Square Garden Crusades
back in the
50s,
yeah.
which is really 16 weeks in a row, just unbelievable. And you said the thing you noticed about Dr. Graham was his humor.
Yeah.
He's funny.
Yeah, he was. And he was adept. And actually, he had two kinds of humor. In person, I was with him several times in person. In person, he was very witty, and he would catch you off guard, and it was truly funny.
Yeah.
And you weren't expecting it when it would come. The humor that on the platform was more corny. I mean, there's just no other word for it. Hmm. And the same jokes, year after year, people knew those jokes were coming, and they laughed harder every time they heard them. But he refined them. The timing was perfect. He knew exactly how to come out with the punchline.
Yeah.
But he was extremely adept at knowing that humor could break an audience up, break the ice, I mean to say. And once the ice is broken, then that was the entry
Absolutely.
For more serious matters.
Well, you saw that happen with all of his interviews that he would do.
Yeah.
Whether it was Dick Cavett or Johnny Carson, Larry King was always fascinating.
Yeah.
But he was on Woody Allen's show a couple times.
Yeah.
And his humor completely took over the room. And you could see Woody Allen was in over his head.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I don't know how to. This guy's this great godly man. Yeah. He's very funny. Yeah. He's very witty. And he was very quick.
I don't think Woody Allen expected that.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know that much about Woody Allen, but you can sort of see from his face that he was surprised. But he started laughing, too.
Oh, my goodness.
It was genuine. And the audience was with him. And just as one example of what was clearly spontaneous on Graham's part is that Woody Allen says, now you believe the whole Bible. And Graham says, yeah. And so Allen says, and so do you believe in the Ten Commandments? And Graham says, yeah. So then Allen says, now which is your favorite commandment? And Graham said, well, as the father of five teenagers, I would say, honor your father and mother. Well, of course, you know, the audience, just, there's a gale of laughter.
Right,
yeah,
of
there a lot of other interchanges there that were, I think, very funny.
Oh, yeah. And that was just, it was amazing to watch him. And that's a real gift, to be able to maintain that your allegiance to the Bible, your allegiance to the Word of God, your allegiance to the gospel, your allegiance to the truth of the gospel, which is hard for the world to hear sometimes because of the exclusivity of the claim, but yet so relatable and funny and down on the level. So when you wrote the first book about Billy Graham, which was about his ministry, versus writing One Soul at a Time, which is about his ministry, did you feel like coming out of that first book that you had the second one in you?
Yes.
Like, and I definitely got to write more about him and less about, quote unquote, the ministry.
That's exactly right. And the first one is actually very much about America. And at that time, I believed and still do that he helped create American culture, but the American culture helped create him, too.
Yeah.
It was an interaction. And you can't understand Graham, and to some extent you can't understand modern America without him. In this book, I've tried to look at just the story of the man, and my theme was, how would he tell his own story?
Wow.
And obviously I went, and that's not exactly what happened, because sometimes I said more than he would have said, and sometimes less. In reference to the more, I would bring in some of his extraordinary achievements, which he wouldn't do on his own.
Right, of course.
And then also some of the defects in his ministry and the mistakes. And sometimes outsiders can see those things better than your own person.
Yeah.
On the other side,
because the first book was just called America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a 30,000-foot look at the whole ministry and the phenomenon, really.
Right, yeah. This one I try to bring it right out on the ground. And look at some things, I mentioned but don't dwell on. I mean, he loved lemon cake, for example. He was a habitual nail biter. He was an insomniac, a terrible insomniac from early into the end of his life. So he had these personal traits that are interesting, but interesting is not the same as important.
Yeah.
So I don't deal with that kind of thing, but what I do try to focus on are the ways that he would have told his own story, what he thought was important.
Yeah. So how do you boil that down? I mean, is it try to capture one of the most iconic men to ever walk the face of the planet? And I don't think that's an overstatement, especially in the context of religion in general and Christianity specifically. But what would you say you ended up focusing on?
Right. Great question. You really ask good questions. You come right to the heart of it. Yeah. I had a very fine editor named David Bratt, is at Erdman's, and he asked the same question. And so together we came to the idea of creating not chapters but scenes. And the book has 54 scenes. And what I tried to do, Steve, is find momentous episodes or scenes that illumine the rest of his life. You know, what's really significant here? So I go back to the New York Crusade as an example. How does that New York Crusade illumines so much else. And here you see Graham exploiting, in the good sense of the word, exploiting the media masterfully.
Oh, yeah.
Television, radio, advertisements on buses. And he was so shrewd about this. Now, he had people helping him, of course, but he took a minimalist approach to a lot of the advertising. And so you would see a poster on a bus that would simply say, "Here, Billy,"
Wow, that's
well, you see, I mean, people say, well, yeah, what?
You're
you
know, Billy, what?
Yeah, what are we talking about
yeah,
here?
Yeah, what do we need to well, listen to?
So they go out and they ask questions,
right,
you
of
know?
Course.
Yeah. And his view of it was like, he said, it's a lot like advertising a Cadillac. You don't have to say much about it. You just say Cadillac.
Cadillac.
Here. Yeah, yeah. So that scene of what he did in New York and then the relentless, absolutely relentless concern for bringing people to Christ.
Yeah.
The decision cards. That's what it was all about, is the decision cards. And he knew, of course, that many people would make decisions in their heart and wouldn't sign a card.
Sure.
But symbolically, to bring that decision forward. And he, not rarely, said that every one of his sermons, ultimately, was about John 3:16.
Yeah, always brought you to that.
Yeah, and one more thing I think is really important. Is that he said, I preached for a verdict. I wanted people to make a decision, up or down.
Yeah.
You know, the program is called Hour of Decision.
Hour of Decision, right. And now I've done a lot of work in the past with Greg Laurie,
uh-huh.
who has been on Billy's board for years.
Yeah.
And later in Billy's crusade ministry in those last 5 or 6 years, he would actually, because Greg's very gifted in taking what's going on out in the world and what's going on in pop culture and bringing that into a gospel message. So he would actually help Billy towards the end. But Greg says the same thing. Every time I preach, I'm preaching for a decision. And
yeah,
he got
yeah.
that
yeah.
from his mentor,
yeah,
his evangelistic mentor was Billy Graham. I want to talk about kind of the spiritual side of what do we say? Okay, that's all God.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do we say? This was Billy and the mm-hmm. way God made him. I want to talk about that and just the kind of toll it took on him. Also, his preaching changed over time
mm-hmm.
and use of the Old Testament versus the New Testament. I have some interesting things there, and we'll talk about all of that. We're talking to Dr. Grant Wacker about Billy Graham. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. Theology Thursday, talking to one of our Christian brothers from the other side of the tracks. That's
mm-hmm.
how we would look at it here in Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
Because we're on the Raleigh side, but you were a professor for 25 years at Duke Divinity, which is over there in the Duke area, which is kind of like the opposite side of the tracks. That's just the way we operate in the triad. And then there's since there's an unholy trinity going on, we have NC State,
right,
Chapel Hill,
right,
the Tar
right.
Heels, and then we have Duke. But
I moved to Cary, so now
oh,
I've,
yeah.
I've got all members of the Trinity working with me.
Yeah,
here.
So you're yeah. good. It's good to have all three of them
yeah,
as
yeah,
opposed
yeah.
to just two or one. But Dr. Wacker wrote several years ago, he wrote a book called America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation, which is really more about the ministry of Billy Graham and that kind of phenomenon. And then the newer book is called One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham, which is definitely focused on Billy the person. So how do you gather the information for this? Because he preached, we know that, he preached a lot. There's a gazillion books that kind of talk about Graham, public appearances, interactions with world leaders, but you're really trying to capture who this guy is, but kind of behind the facade, if I can use that word, and behind the well-known ministry guy. Where do you go? Like, where do you pull from?
Initially, it was discouraging because it is so overwhelming. I mean, you know, it's like trying to write a book about Abraham Lincoln or FDR or something. It's just vast. So you got to make choices. And very early on, you decide you have to make choices. And make choices among other biographers because everybody has their own take. I do. And what kind of media you're going to look at, what kind of record. So I had to make some choices. And the choice I tried to make early on is the differences I mentioned earlier between what's important and what's interesting. Some very fine books that are about what's interesting about
sure.
Graham, you know, personal anecdotes and stuff. But I wanted to look at what's important. And by important, my notion was what had lasting impact on the culture, both in the U.S. and internationally. And maybe later, I hope we can talk about this, the international Graham is possibly more important than the American Graham.
Well, that's where you mentioned yeah, Abraham yeah. Lincoln, but Abraham yeah, Lincoln yeah. really only operated in the American context.
Right, right.
Yeah, FDR, yeah. more than that.
Yeah.
There's modern presidents, more
yeah,
than that.
Yeah.
But nobody, I don't think, do you think there's been a single individual in the last 1,000 years that has had the kind of favor and acceptance around the world that Billy Graham had?
No. Protestant individuals.
Yeah.
Now, I think John Paul II
yeah.
Certainly right.
I would agree
him.
With that,
yeah.
yeah.
But other than John Paul II, nobody. And this, Graham started traveling internationally in the 1940s at the very beginning. He's
wow.
a very young man. But the number of international visits and crusades steadily grew, and by the 1970s, my guess, I'd have to quantify this, but my guess is the majority of his public appearances were international. He cared about the global gospel.
Yeah.
And didn't want it to be an American gospel. Now, sometimes when he got overseas, they still saw it as an American gospel.
Sure.
You can't
sure.
ever,
you know, right, right.
You can't ever divest yourself of who you are. But he certainly tried to make it a universal gospel.
Would he have been comfortable with this kind of question where I go, okay, how much of this is the way who Billy Graham was as a person mm-hmm. versus just what God decided to do with him? Does that make sense?
No.
So,
yeah,
so
to keep going.
So we go, how much of Billy Graham's quote-unquote success, impact, is based on this unique blend of character traits, mm-hmm. what he was concerned about, versus just the Holy Spirit's just going to pick the guy up and use him.
Okay.
But there's some aspects about Billy Graham that made him particularly usable.
Yeah. And Steve, you're raising the larger theological question of how do we deal theologically the Graham story, and that's, you know,
that's another book.
That's another book. It's very difficult. I'll say straight up that I tried to write a story for other historians, but at the same time, my own conviction is that he was God's person for the hour.
Yeah,
just as maybe all of us are. We hope.
Yeah, one way or another.
Yeah,
and that's just God's sovereignty. And
I
praise the Lord
that.
For it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to figure it all out.
That's exactly right.
So,
yeah.
So you mentioned that you kind of unpack this in terms of scenes,
yeah,
scenes from
yeah.
his life. And how many in the book?
54. There could have been 154 easily,
sure.
or 2,054, or you know, fewer. But as I just wrote the story almost spontaneously. My daughter owns a cabin in the mountains of Georgia, and I went down the cabin, and I just started writing. And
because you had learned a lot already.
I'd already learned, yeah. And so I started writing the story. And then after I'd written that story, then I went back and seemed to me that it kind of divided itself into natural segments.
So, I was going to ask, is it chronological?
Or yes, yes.
Okay.
It's not strictly. I mean, nobody lives their life strictly chronologically. I mean, we remember who we were
right,
and
right.
bring it into the present. But generally, it's chronological. And so, and that's difficult. It's very difficult to manage that as a historian. So, for example, Graham and race, it keeps coming up. And so early events I tried to tell in their own terms. And then later on, the issue comes up again. Well, in Graham's case, it becomes especially complicated because he dealt with a lot of things at once. He was not a one-track man.
Right.
I mean, at any given time, he's on the radio and television and preaching.
And speaking to a lot of different issues and being asked about a lot of different
issues. And he's playing golf with presidents.
Yeah,
and he's also a home man. He has 5 kids and a strong marriage and family life. So all these things are going on all at once.
Yeah,
well, what are you going to pick out? And so that's where I had to make some decisions as to what I thought he thought.
Well, let's focus on the race part for a while, because
okay.
you mentioned this before on the break, so only our friends on Facebook Live could hear it. Was he noticed at the 16 weeks of crusades at Madison Square Garden in New York City that it was particularly white?
It was, and
that bugged him.
It was in the beginning; it was overwhelmingly white.
Yeah,
and he recognized early on that there's something wrong with this, and so he another story, but he had already invited a Christian Missionary Alliance pastor named Howard Jones to join him, not as an associate at that time. Later on, Jones became an associate, but at that time, just to join him, sit on the platform, and then advise him, mm-hmm. what can we do about this?
Wow.
And Jones said, everything about this crusade is white. Everybody on the platform is white. All the singers are white. All the people are white. So you have to take your message to where, as he said at that time, the blacks are. You go to them, and or you go to us. And that's exactly what Graham did. He took his crusade into Harlem and into predominantly African-American sections of Brooklyn and Queens, and then growing Latinos. All right, that's one thing he did. Second thing he did is he invited Martin Luther King to pray.
When was that?
Was it during those crusades, or was it later? I misspoke. July 18. It may have been 17. I don't know. I'd have to check.
But was it in, was it the New York City Crusades?
Oh, yeah, that's
early, in the 1950s.
1957, and King was criticized. Graham received venomous criticism, especially from Southern fundamentalists.
Yeah, wow.
Now, I should say, you know, we don't want to glorify this event. I mean, King came, his prayer was very tempered, I would say. He did not give a complete endorsement to Graham, although he at least came and prayed. And the same time, Graham's response, I say, was tempered. He did not give a roundhouse embrace of King. I mean, these men, it's a very complicated relationship. So I don't want to see it all through roseate glasses. I mean, these are human beings who are trying to deal with a terribly difficult issue and difference between them. King focused on the social justice part, and Graham focused on changing the heart.
Change the heart, and then you'll eventually change society.
And it took time to integrate.
Now, what about in the 60s? And Graham's, because there was some contention there that he should have been more outspoken with the civil rights movement and all of that. So was that a significant part of who he was?
Briefly, as I mentioned earlier, it was not a linear development. He grew from a strictly segregationist point of view in the 40s. Early 50s, I'd say, was one of the handsome parts of his career. In the early 50s, before Brown versus Board of Education, he made a decision he would no longer preach to segregated audiences. And he caught a lot of resistance.
Oh, I'm sure.
Tremendous resistance and criticism. But he did it. In the late 50s and into maybe the early 60s, he really staked out a progressive position. The mid-60s, he stepped back. And there's just no way to get around that. And it was not his commitment to racial integration, but rather his fear of social turmoil.
Yeah.
He stepped back. He became worried about what King was doing.
Yeah.
Then the 70s, we have another step forward.
Yeah, interesting. And then you have to, and this, I think modern pastors have the same challenge. I have to be concerned that I'm getting mixed up with something that will be a stumbling block to the gospel.
Yeah.
Is racial equality important? Absolutely. But the souls of men, more important?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, yes. 'Cause you are more than I could ever dream. This world could ever see. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, talking to Dr. Grant Wacker today, who taught for 25 years at the Duke Divinity School. He got his BA from Stanford and a PhD from Harvard. So, you know, we're basically twin giants intellectually, which is a joke. That's me being ridiculous. Anyway, I really appreciate you driving up from Cary today and being on the show. I appreciate Todd Von Helms, our mutual friend, for reminding me about you, and praise the Lord that you could get in here. We're talking about Grant's most recent book, which is about Billy Graham, One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham. I put the links up on Facebook Live, but if you just Google it, you'll find it, which is a follow-up to his first book about Billy, called America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation, which was really looking at the ministry and the impact. This one looking at Billy Graham, the man. And I know one thing you really wanted to talk about was his character. So, I mean, when I think character and Billy Graham, I, of course, think of the Modesto Manifesto, and they realize, okay, God's doing something crazy here, we need to be, as much as is humanly possible with God's aid, above reproach, never going to be alone with a woman, all kinds of restrictions how he traveled, not going to handle the money, all that kind of stuff. But it seems like he was a man of really amazing character. Are we over the top hyperbole with that? Or what did you learn? What do you think about Billy Graham's character?
Well, there are two things. One, as I started to talk about, is the personal humility. And the second is the life of personal probity. As you mentioned, chastity within marriage or any hint of sexual immorality, keeping his financial affairs above board, everything audited, and not in this, what it comes down to is picking fights.
Yeah.
Avoid fights was one of his main goals. And the press sometimes overlooked that. They got fixated on the issue of absolute sexual morality and, to some extent, the financial integrity. But he also had a very strong conviction about not needlessly going around and picking fights.
He wasn't going to die on a lot of hills.
Absolutely.
Just the gospel.
Absolutely. And actually, there's almost no evidence of Graham ever having a theological debate. It just wasn't his nature.
Yeah.
What he wanted to do is preach the gospel. Yeah. And he said it's fine to have people out there who want to debate.
Yeah.
But that's just not me.
That wasn't his call.
Yeah, yeah.
His calling.
Yeah, I made a mistake a moment ago, and I spoke of chastity within marriage. I mean, chastity until marriage.
Sure, sure.
But then,
I hope he didn't. Normal, I hope he didn't express chastity within marriage.
No.
I hope he enjoyed the gift that God gave us.
And he did.
We know at least five times.
Yeah. Well, he had five children. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know of anyone who has seriously charged him with violating any of these principles.
Which is especially remarkable given the spiritual target he had on his head.
Absolutely.
But now, most of us are not going to get any attention from Satan himself. Billy Graham would.
He did.
And it's crazy to think, because how long would you say his evangelistic career was? 50 years?
60.
60 years that what you just said, nobody could really make a credible charge on the financial side, on the sexual side, and that is mind-boggling.
And his irenic approach, inclusive approach, bring as many people as possible within the range of the gospel. And then you can draw some theological distinctions.
Because what was that number? How many people did he preach to over that 60 years?
Very interesting question. He preached live, eye to eye, to 77 million people.
In person.
Now, the Graham Organization will tell you 185 million, and that's fudging things a bit. The difference between the 77 and the 185 is that live satellite feed.
Got it.
Okay,
Simulcast location.
Yeah, but it'd be hard to find anyone else who's preaching to 77 million eye to eye.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we're in the minutiae there.
Yeah. I mean, and it was more, I think it was 56 countries. That he actually, put his feet down on, and just the stamina that took, and all of that, Steve, above reproach, and this is one of the things he was getting at. Let's go back to the question of not being alone with woman, in your family. The press has really exaggerated that. I mean, what he's trying to say is use your common sense.
I mean,
don't it's the candlelight dinner in Paris.
Right.
With a woman who's not your wife. I mean, that's what he's getting at.
Yeah.
And there's no criticism. Could I get the humility part, though? That was the part that most struck me, is how frequently he was willing to apologize, and by all evidence, he meant it. Sometimes apology can just be a tactic, and it wasn't. I mean, it really came up for him as honestly, and he only saw himself as a vessel. Again and again, he said to me, my wife, when the times were with him, said, I have no idea why God chose me. And he'd say, I'm just a farm kid from North Carolina.
From North Carolina, right.
But somehow, for some reason, he chose me to do this important work. Now, he never minimized the importance of the work. A lot of people say, aw, shucks, it wasn't all that important. He didn't do that.
Yeah, he knew.
He knew. He knew who he was. He knew the power he had. But he also immediately said, I am simply the person that God happened to choose.
Now, how do you explain that level of humility? Can you? I mean, is that the kind of the most interesting thread as you wrote out these 50-plus scenes from his life? Was that the thing that was most fascinating to you?
Yeah.
With all the accolades, all the attention. Yeah. That literally one of the most well-known people in the history of the world and he's still that humble.
Yeah, and I don't want to put roseate glass. See that?
Sure.
I mean, there were times when...
Not perfect humility.
Well, right now there are more than 1.1 million photographs of him in the Billy Graham archives. Well, he knew he was... I mean, he didn't pose for all those, of course, but, but I mean, he knew that he was handsome, all right, and he knew how that worked with the media. And so we have these human, very human traits that come out. But on balance, it's just striking the way that he approached people. And as I say, when my wife and I visited with him four times, and just immediately you would sense.
What were the circumstances around that?
His associates and his sister arranged for us to visit with him. And,
was this leading up to the first book?
Yeah. And he lives on a mountain, or he lived on a mountain.
Oh, yeah, Montreat, near Black Mountain, North Carolina, and right off I-40.
Yeah, I'd say that these are mountaintop experiences in both senses of the word.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
In fact, as we left, we tried to write down everything that he said and did just so we wouldn't forget. But wow. None of this was orchestrated, of course. I mean, it's just who he was. And
so you go into Billy Graham's house, and he's just... Would you like a Coke?
That's exactly. Actually, in his case, it was iced tea. Yeah, and he was far more interested in talking to my wife than he was talking to me. I mean, he wanted to talk about Tar Heel basketball. And at that time, we happened to live in Chapel Hill, and I taught at Duke. And he said, well, now if you teach at Duke, how come you're living in Chapel Hill? Doesn't that give you some crisis of conscience here? And, I mean, he was so down home. Hmm. And I can just tell one story quickly that I think makes the point. When we first saw him, his aide said, Billy, Grant is writing a book about you. And he instantly said, why? That took me back. And so I said,
that's crazy.
You've done some important things. And then he said, no, the Lord has done important things through me.
Wow. And that was totally genuine.
Absolutely genuine.
That wasn't this answer is going to appear in a book.
Right.
That was just Billy Graham.
But what struck me, Steve, is that he didn't disparage the work. He didn't deny that he'd done important things.
Yeah.
Because that would be denying God's work.
Yeah, what God did.
Yeah. So he embraced, he owned the compliment, but at the same time he turned it. And you'd have to be there. I mean, any cynic could say, oh, well, he was just, following an
evangelical script. But
you can tell.
Somebody that's genuine, you can tell.
Absolutely.
So from what your experience and your time with him and your research and from the book, One Soul at a Time, I'm here with Dr. Grant Wacker, what would you suggest to us, or a couple things about Billy, we only have about a minute and a half left, that we should really try to emulate?
Easily. His integrity. Spiritual integrity. And the personal integrity that he maintained in the way he lived his life. And when he died, an Indian theologian from India made the comment. He said his message was his life. Mm. And I thought that brilliantly captured the entire story.
Talk about, and I hear James out there somewhere saying, you show me your faith by what you say, and I'll show you my faith by what I do. Mm-hmm. And you look at the integrity of life, and not perfect, but well beyond what most of us human beings, even followers of Christ, would achieve. And you can't argue with his integrity. Therefore, how can you possibly argue with the gospel or his message?
Yeah. He lived 99 years. There were a lot of times he had a lot of chances.
Oh my goodness.
To mess up.
Yeah, and he just didn't.
And he did make mistakes, of course, at different times and places he made mistakes. But he was the first to say so.
How's Billy rubbed off on you?
It's been he provided for me a model of how I would want to live my life in terms of integrity, in honesty, spiritual discipline. He spent the first half hour of every day reading his Bible.
Yeah, totally the real deal.
The real deal. I love that. That could have been the title.
Yeah. That was a phrase my dad always used to say when he meets somebody that's genuine and you go, Dad, what'd you think of so-and-so? He'd say, oh, he's the real deal.
Yeah.
Which actually, my dad had dinner with Billy Graham once in Weslaco, Texas. My dad worked at LBJ's TV station down there.
Okay.
Billy came through town and my dad had a chance to interview him and had dinner with him. And I remember asking him once I was awake spiritually, Dad, what'd you think about Billy Graham? And my dad would get, you would see it. And he'd say, he was the real deal.
He was.
This is exactly what you're saying.
I promise you, he was.
Dr. Grant Wacker, so great to see you. Thanks for coming in here. It's great to talk about this. I wish we had more time. One Soul at a Time is the name of the book, The Story of Billy Graham. One Soul at a Time by Dr. Grant Wacker. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about a lot of things, God willing. And like my dad always used to say, as a matter of fact, ever forward.